Good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending this morning's session. I'm Yolanda Davila, and Dr. Mendias, my partner, is unable to attend today and sends her regrets, okay? She's my colleague, and we've done a lot of information or a lot of work on this. So just go ahead and start. We have nothing to disclose either. And now we're going to talk about intimate partner violence. What it is threat or the actual physical, sexual, or psychological assault of one partner by another partner. It occurs within same-sex as well as heterosexual couples. This morning's presentation is more aligned towards the heterosexual couples, specifically women as the victims of violence and males as the perpetrators. That's not to say that I do not recognize that there is mutual violence where both partners in a relationship are violent towards one another, okay? There's also those kind of relationships in which females are the perpetrators of the violence, as well as the males only being the perpetrators. I focus on women primarily because one thing, men very often, it's put it in the literature, use the violence more frequently and more severely, with women obtaining more severe injury. Every year, about 4 to 6 million women experience violence, and this is probably underreported. There's a lot of shame and guilt and fear associated with the violence, and many times as healthcare providers, we don't ask as well either. So you can see that it's associated with 81% of the women who experience violence suffering some kind of short or long-term impact towards their health. You can see from here, and this is taken from CDC, that there is PTSD is one, concern for safety. And look in terms of the injury. Of those 81%, 42% of them have some kind of injury, with 22% of those meeting some kind of medical care, be it physical or psychological care. Why is it important? Well, intimate partner violence comes out to a cost of $8.3 billion a year in terms of direct services, healthcare services to women. We're not talking in terms of money that goes towards the legal system, the justice system, loss of productivity or work or any of those things. The health consequences of IPV range from physical, sexual, and psychological. Physical, we're more attuned to in terms of the injury, the disability, even the cause of death, perhaps. Psychological, in terms of depression, alcohol and substance abuse, PTSD, and suicide. And sexual, we're seeing much of that coming around, too, in terms of forced or coerced sex, unprotected sex, women being unable to take care of their sexual health using birth control. So you can see those. And the IPV is associated with higher risk behaviors. And I'll show you those, too. As you can see, it's a little busy on the slide here, but this, again, is taken from CDC. When you take a look at the health conditions that women have, that's one of them that you can see. But I'm looking in terms of the risk behaviors, and that's one of my interests, is the intersection of HIV, STDs, and intimate partner violence. You can see that women, and that's the adjusted odds ratio, women with violent partners have a 3.1 odds ratio of getting an HIV or STD. They also do a lot of heavy or binge drinking. Again, this is a very difficult lifestyle to live, and very often it's self-medication. One of the other things that you'll see, too, is many times that the partners are drink alcohol or use injection drugs or any kind of drugs, they kind of bring their female partner into it as well, too. Okay. What we're looking at here is a socio-ecological model of intimate partner violence. Very often we focus on the individual and we kind of forget that the individual is not always the person that's being influenced. They have other factors that influence them. And you can see why I like this model. You have your individual, and I really should have dotted this arrow across, because you have the individual, the interpersonal, the community, and the societal levels that influence a woman's experience of violence. And they're interrelated, and they are across the boundaries. Individual, at the level of the individual, you do have biology, you do have age, you do have racial ethnicity. These things, of course, you can't intervene for. But just some of the ideas, one thing that you see very often is young age. You see that especially with the younger women when their partners are at least 3 to 5 years older or more. They assume a position of authority within the relationship. Sometimes it is associated with cultural expectations as well as financial resources, giving the male power and control within the relationship. Low education, you can see very often women without any kind of education or low education do not have financial resources of their own. What's their employment status? What kind of employment? When you get $7.15 or whatever now that the, what do you call that? Minimum wage, thank you. When you figure it out, it's what, maybe $280 before taxes? Can you live on your own? You can see that, you know, you're living a life of poverty, and very often there's a lot of stressors associated with poverty. Wake up in the morning and the car doesn't work, or the child is sick and you can't miss work because you'll get fired. So you can see a lot of these interplays that are coming through. Childhood sexual abuse. Women that have experienced childhood sexual abuse are more likely to become victims of violence within their own relationships later in their adult relationships. And witnessing family violence. You know, think back, who are the role models for young kids? It's the parents, family of origin. And the research shows that for women that grow up in abusive households where dad is hitting mom, to them they don't have another reference point. So it's more of a normalization. If they've been in one violent relationship as an adult, they very often we may leave that partner and find themselves in another violent relationship. Again, you don't have another reference point. You don't learn from the mistakes that you've had before, or put the cognition that he has these behaviors and this one is showing these behaviors. He may be a perpetrator. You can see depression again, and I talked a little about that. You know, does the depression cause the partner violence, or does the violence cause the depression? We really don't know that. But think in terms of women that are depressed. Where is their cognition, their ability to think and to protect themselves? Okay, impaired judgment. How do you, when you're depressed, you can't really think outside the box. You focus on yourself. You don't have the energy, the concentration, or anything else to protect yourself. Alcohol and substance abuse, I talked a little bit about that already. Again, you have impaired judgment and cognition. You cannot assess your situation adequately or correctly. In pregnancy, the research showed that if you are pregnant and you have not been physically or sexually or psychologically abused, there is a likelihood to increase, again, depending on your partner. Okay, and if there is already abuse within the relationship, the pregnancy may cause it to become more frequent and severe. You have on the interpersonal level, again, couple conflict and discord. Very often we don't understand about how to negotiate conflict in certain families that are abusive. Okay, you use aggression, you use physical force or violence. Stressors of poverty, I've met a little bit about that in terms of the couples. Again, if they're both unemployed or underemployed, how do you support your family? If you have an alcohol or a substance abuse problem, can you actually work? Or do you, are you living a life of poverty because of it? Family and peer norms are very important in the interpersonal level. Again, go back to your family of origin. They are the role models that we have. And your peers, if it's acceptable to peers, to your friends, to your coworkers, again, it's a more of a normalization. This is an expectation. You don't see anything odd about it. So you use the violence. And I've put here partners a great deal again, too, because, again, we're talking about intimate partner violence. The partners, those men or those young boys that grow up in violent homes, are more likely to become abusers themselves in their adult relationships. And if they've had violence, or they've used violence before, or they perhaps might have a criminal record for the use of violence or been arrested before, they're more likely to continue to use violence to get what they want or to resolve any kind of conflict. Traits and disorders, they too, if they have alcohol or substance abuse problems, again, you can see where the inhibitions that might keep people from using aggression or lashing out, those are gone. Okay. Those with, in terms of mood disorders too, in terms of depression, they can be extremely irritable. Again, setting off a violent episode. And the presence of children very often is a risk factor. And as I'm a psych nurse by trade here, okay? And working at a battered women's shelter, very often what I would hear is the women say, I don't have any job skills. I don't have any of my money of my own. I stay with him because of my kids. They have a home. They have a roof over their head. They have clothing. They have food. They have shelter. Or sometimes you can see that they stay within the relationship because he threatens, if you leave me, I will kill the children or I will hurt the children. So you can see that these are risk factors that women have. Community level, we think in terms of neighborhood characteristics. Think in terms about neighborhoods that have high crime rates. What does that say? Again, you have a normalization of the use of aggression, of the use of physical force to get resources that you need, to get your way, to resolve any kind of conflict or discord that occurs. Community norms that are supportive of violence. Okay. Think in terms of your communities. Do you have battered women's shelters? What about the district attorney? Okay. Do they have a no report policy, where if perhaps there is a report of domestic violence, the police respond to it. What do? Do they walk away because they don't see any kind of injury or anything? Okay. Some of the laws, again, they actually still have to see some evidence of violence before they can do this. We community sanctions against violence. Think about us as a society very often, okay? Do we really condemn violence very often? I leave that to you to think about some of the communities that you see. Again, working in a battered women's shelter and working in a low poverty socioeconomic level, there is a lot of use of violence again. And you can see that violence to get what you want is accepted. And there's not very many sanctions against it. Societal level factors that influence it. A very rigid gender roles with male dominance. Fortunately, we're still kind of a patriarchal society, no matter what. And men usually have better positions, right? Work positions. They have more money. They have more status. They have more prestige. Again, an expectation sometimes in terms of culture are that the women would be more submissive and be aligned with what their partner expects. Think about the social norms about entertainment. And I ask you, what are the last movies that you saw? Pardon me? Seven Psychopaths, okay. Was there violence? Feral violence, yeah. And... they're entertainment. We kind of get used to it. I hate to tell you, I've been watching sci-fi and all these Halloween-y kind of movies with vampires and all this other good stuff, and they're pretty gruesome, right? And what else do you see? The subjugation of women. Women as sexual objects, many times. Our use of sexual violence against women. It's entertainment. Think of some of our sports figures as well, too. Some of the things that they've done.
Mm-hmm. A lot of times you get workers who think the father's a stabilizing factor in the house, although he's the violent one and they kill the nurse thrown in there.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've had that threatened a few times. And they want to keep the father in the house, and I'm saying, but you're raising three or four more sons to be violent. Don't you get it?
Yeah.
And then they get mad at me.
Right. And that's, again, it can be either community or societal, organizational, or more of a societal. You're right. Because we want to keep the family together. We think in terms that a father and a mother together are better for the kids, and it's not necessarily so. But that is how we have been socialized.
I agree with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is a big problem. And then again, about the linkage of masculinity to aggression. So you can see where some of these influence and factors are kin. And many of these are not in control, are the women's control. So you can intervene for the woman at the individual level, but it's when you start intervening at all the multiple levels that you get a better response and a longer lasting response. So when you think in terms of guiding principles for it, and I've already talked a little bit about this, multiple levels of intervention. Yes, it's great to do the individual, but don't stop there. What about the interpersonal, the community? Again, as public health nurses, we're advocates. We're out there. We're policy changers. Multiple methods of teaching, and make sure that you include skills. Knowledge is good. But if you can't apply that knowledge into a situation that will help you to protect yourself or your children, it doesn't do that much good. It's having the skills to think, what do I do in this situation? And again, of a dose effect, so many times, and I know with funding, we go in and we do it one time because that's all we can do. It's better than nothing. But when we can do a repetitive, to give them a little more of a reinforcement, it works so much better. And again, talking about evidence-based theory, that's the best way to do. And to have it when it's the maximum impact. What we're finding from the research on intimate partner violence, it's when the woman presents at the emergency room or at the clinicians or maybe even in a health or social service or to the police, fresh from the injury, okay? This is when she is more receptive to intervention. She really understands there's a problem here. And that goes into the cycle of violence, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But this is the best time when the woman presents herself. If you wait too long, he goes back to being the usual person and friend and provider and all these things, so you lose there. Culturally tailored, not just for groups. Gender, I would say that you do some for men. You do them for women. Okay, thank you. And for communities as well. And you spoke very much... I can't remember your first name. But you talked about being in congruence with the communities, what is acceptable or not. And then, again, any intervention, you really want to know it's been effective or not. You don't want to just do it because it's tried and it's what we've always done. Does it really make a difference? So at the individual level, one of the good things to do is screening for intimate partner violence. Okay, I know that JACO says that we're supposed to do it, but do we actually when you have those 15 minutes to look at all these patients? If you can't do it yourself, see if you can have someone else do the screening. And again, alcohol and drug use, and I would even put in depression. Screen for all of those. They're a triad that you see very frequently. Okay. So if you don't screen, if you don't identify a problem, how can you even begin to address it? Treatment, of course, counseling, psychotherapy is very important. Referral to the community health and social agencies that can be useful. Many times these women live in isolation and they aren't aware of what is out there. Education for the beliefs, the knowledge, and the attitudes. One of the things to tell women is that this is a crime. A lot of women don't know that, okay? This is an actual crime with prosecution that can take place. The other one is to tell them that they are not alone. There's a lot of humiliation and fear with this and the stigma related to being a victim of partner violence. They always think they're the only ones. To phrase it in terms of this happens to many of my clients, it takes away that and makes it more of a generalizable. Interpersonal level healthy relationships, and I stress that we start very young with our adolescents or even our school-age children. You know, how do you resolve conflict? How do you do negotiations? What about effective coping skills and methods when you're in some kind of situation that is detrimental to your health or to you in some way? And again, why not have it for our teenagers as well? This is when they're actually getting into these sexual relationships. And again, I've had the young girls tell me, but he loves me. Love doesn't hurt, folks, okay? And you got to get that across to them, these healthy relationships. Thinking in terms of education on the family impact, very often the couples don't really understand. They're so centered on themselves, male and the female, that they forget about the children. What effect does it have on these kids? And you tell them, these are why your kids are having these disruptive behaviors, so they're not doing well in school. academic failures and all these things, bring out the terms of the family, the importance of the family. Again, treatment, counseling, and referral, always. Support groups are very, very good. Again, being with people that are having the same similar situations and that are dealing with will help others to open up, to learn new ways. And then home visitations. I know that with public health funding going down, this is not as easy as it sounds, but they have been proven to work so well. You know, you can go in, you can assess for stressors, you can refer again to any kind of agencies that's needed. You can role model behaviors if you have cranky kids. I mean, think about it. You already have a stressful family situation between the couple, and then you have this crying kid, right? If you can show them and how to role model appropriate behaviors, parenting behaviors, that actually does help. Community levels, again, coalition building for shared resources. One of the best places that I worked was at San Antonio Family Violence Prevention Services. They actually had on site a dentist, a nurse practitioner, I have to hurry, the district attorney, the St. Mary's Law School interns would come in. They had someone from the food stamp and Medicaid, all in one service. Why duplicate them? One site, everyone's there, you don't have to do it over. Campaign policies, we still need to say that violence is a crime and that it's out there and that it's harmful to families. Strengthening the social norms, putting out some kind of sanctions against violence. That's the no-drop policy. That was in San Antonio. If the police came out and there was even a suspicion of violence, they would go look for the perpetrator if he was not there, and if he was there, they would take him and they would jail him overnight, okay, until they were able to get the situation under control. Before that, they used to just go away and say, well, he's not doing anything to you. We can't do anything. Society level, again, the health and the social policies, the Violence Against Women Act was phenomenal, okay? But we can do that and more in terms of what else is needed. Public health policies that give women education, give them job skills, provide them with housing and all those other things that are important. Evidence-based practice, as school base is a big place to go. These are upcoming adults, okay? What are they learning and how are they going to cope in future relationships with future stressors? And then the mass media has been one of the best ones. If you can get community leaders to come and speak against violence and do those little commercial blurbs that they do out, bringing it and saying it's unacceptable, that goes a long way towards helping intervene for violence. And I'm out of time, so I thank you very much.